Turn to Proverbs 5 and verse 20. We're just going to have a few more verses tonight, and then one more next time, and we'll be done talking about the strange woman for a while, thankfully. Unfortunately, then Solomon picks up with her again in the second half of chapter 6 and all of chapter 7, and so you'll hear about her again. Proverbs 5 and verse 20. It says, "And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger?" So let's look at that first part. "And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman?" This is what you call a rhetorical question, which means it's a question that really is functioning as a statement. You're asking somebody something and they should know the answer themselves, and it doesn't really demand an answer. So Solomon directly commanded his son to stay far away from the strange woman in verse 8, and now he appeals to his son's reason by way of asking a question. So he's given him the direct instruction, and now it's as if he tells him the command, and then he gives him the reasons for it, and then he says, "Why would you want to do this?" And he kind of gets his son thinking, like, on his own. And sometimes that really helps, asking a question and then leaving the hearer to ponder it and come up with the answer on his own can be a powerful way to influence somebody to make the right decision. And it can be a good management tool as well. Like if you have guys working for you, and if you say, "So, you know, what do you think we should do about this?" And then he comes up with an idea, and then maybe if it's not the greatest idea, then you could ask other questions. Well, what about this? What, you know, if we did that, then this might happen. What do you think? You know, what would be the way to get around that? And before you know it, the guy's come up with the answer on his own. You say, "Hey, thanks a lot, that's great." And then he's going to think he came up with it on his own. And then he's going to work twice as hard to make sure it works because it was his idea, when actually it was your idea and you just prompted it through your questions. So it can be a very cunning tool to use. Yes, it is. Yep. It's a form of the Socratic method, asking questions to get somebody to come to the answer on their own. So forming the warning as a question allows his son to come up with reasons that it would be foolish for him to get involved with a strange woman. He could be thinking, "I could ruin my marriage, I could end up getting a disease, I could go broke, I could be ashamed of myself." All kinds of things start running through his head, especially since his dad already told him, you know, a number of things that could happen. And whenever it is formed in a question, then all of a sudden he probably thinks about all these things that were just said and said, "Wow, yeah, boy, that'd be terrible if that happened to me." Whereas when it's just instruction, he might not have thought of it until he puts it in the form of a question to him. So when we come to conclusions about dangerous acts ourselves, then we're much more likely to avoid them. So he says, "Why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman?" Now, to be ravished with one's own wife is a good thing. We remember that. We saw that last time in verse 19. It says, "Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breasts satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love." So that's a good thing, but it's an evil thing to be ravished with a strange woman. And it's like I've said, and I've said this several times, but it's not what is done in the bedroom that's the sin. It's who does it in the bedroom that's the sin. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. I just like making this point, I think, because I still remember the first time that I heard it made, and it was so powerful to me and just answered so many questions for me that it's just one of those things that's stuck in my head, and I like to repeat it. Hebrews 13:4 says, "Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge." The marriage bed's undefiled, no matter what's going on in there. But the bed of the whoremonger is sinful no matter what's going on. No matter how monogamous they claim to be, or how much they love each other, or how pure it is, or whatever, it is sinful, period, because the people that are doing it have no business doing it. Now, to be ravished, as you'll remember from last time, is to be carried away by force. Now, what would be the force then that carries away, or that ravishes a person in that kind of love, if you want to call it that? Anybody have any idea what the force is? You already saw it. Lust. Lust is the force. Let's look at 2 Timothy 3 and verse 6. Because it's not a physical force. Right now, a man, the word ravish can mean to rape. Like, so ravish could be a physical force, but whenever a man is being ravished by a woman, typically it's not rape, like a forcible physical thing. It's forced by compulsion due to his nature. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 6. Says, for of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts. This is not necessarily referring to sexual sin. I'm just wanting the point there that lusts will lead you away or carry you away, in other words, or ravish you. And then, of course, we have James 1:14, which explains to us how sin happens. And it starts out with a temptation, and then the lust takes over. And before you know it, when the lust is finished, then it brings about sin, breaking God's law. And then when sin is done, it leaves you with death. James 1 and verse 14 says, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed, drawn away or carried away. Right? It's a forceful, powerful thing. And many men have been brought down by lust. If you think about it, the wisest man, or the man that we're studying here, Solomon, was brought down by lust. All these outlandish women caused him to sin. The strongest man, Samson, was brought down by lust, by a woman. He even said when he saw the woman, he told his parents that, get her to me for wife, for she pleaseth me well. Like he wanted her, and that was it. David, yeah. Good one. I was trying to think of another one. Yes, David, the classic example of a man that was drawn away, that was ravished by his lust. Lust is desire, appetite, relish, or inclination for something. In biblical and theological use, sensuous appetite or desire considered as sinful or leading to sin. Often in the plural, especially in the lusts of the flesh or fleshly lust, and the scripture uses both of those phrases there verbatim. It is, when it goes on and gets more specific with the definition, it is sexual appetite or desire, chiefly and now exclusively implying intense moral reprobation, libidinous desire, degrading animal passion, the chief current use, it says. So a lot of times when we hear lust, we think about sexual passion, sexual lust. It's not the only thing that it refers to, but it is often what it refers to. So the strange woman, like false teachers, allure men through lust. Let's look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 18. And this really fits together well. At first you might think, well, what do false teachers and strange women have in common? You think they'd have nothing in common. But when you realize that God refers to false religion and idolatry in terms of fornication and adultery over and over again in the Old Testament, then all of a sudden we see, oh yes, false teachers and strange women have a lot in common because they are spiritually the same type of thing. Because God refers to sexual sin as idolatry or false doctrine. 2 Peter 2 and verse 18. It says, and when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness. And wantonness, if I'm not mistaken, is like a immoral desire, like has a sexual connotation to it. Through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error. And, you know, there are false teachers that could seduce people into sexual sin. It happens a lot. Preachers get caught up in that scandal all the time. But then again, it works the other way around too. Remember Revelation chapter 3, the woman preacher named Jezebel? And it says that she had taught the brethren to commit fornication with her. So, yeah, she was using great swelling words of vanity, alluring them through the lust of their flesh, quite literally, into a adulterous relationship with her. To allure means to attract by the offer of some advantage or pleasure, to tempt by something flattering or acceptable, to entice, to win over. And this is true of false teachers. They can allure through advantage or pleasure or flattering you, to get you to come to their side. I know of a preacher. I'm not going to mention him by name. I could, but I'm not going to. But this guy uses this same tactic. He allures people. He tried years ago. I know some people, some friends of mine, that he tried to allure into his church by promising them to that they would be like in the inner circle. Basically, you come down here and you're going to be like one of the pillars of this church. Like really trying to flatter them and to get them to see the advantage and entice them to come to my church. Get out of that church that you're in right now. So yeah, false teachers do that. They really do. And a foolish man who goes after the strange woman voluntarily, like an ox goes to the slaughter, he will do so not realizing that it will be his demise. Look at Proverbs 7, 22 through 23. Proverbs 7, 22 through 22, or 22 through 23. And as a matter of fact, another man, referring to that same preacher, after meeting with him, said that after he got finished meeting with him, he felt like he had been emotionally raped, was, I believe, his exact words. So,
must have been very persuasive.
Very persuasive, very charismatic. Yeah, very slick talking. So yeah, there are really men out there that, men of God, supposedly, that act like the strange woman, that use the tactics of the strange woman to draw people to themselves. Proverbs 7, 22 through 23. It says, he goeth after her straightway as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. See, he's just too stupid to even realize it. He goes after her. He believes all of her flattery, and he's wanting to fulfill his desires and lust, and he's just like the ox that just walks right on into the slaughter. He doesn't know what's coming, and before he knows it, bang, he's dead.
Well, don't you think Joel Osteen has that attitude of a flirting, seducing man? He's on TV talking. And women are just crazy about him.
Silly
just
women.
Fall in love with him right and left.
Yep. That's true. Silly women laden with sins that don't have a clue about Bible doctrine and can't see through the guy. You know, all they see is a guy that tells them how to get your best life now, as his famous line is. So why would a man do that then? Why would a man be ravished with a strange woman? Why would a man go after the strange woman when you know what the end is going to be? And that's Solomon's question here. Why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman? And then the next part of the verse, and embrace the bosom of a stranger. Let's talk about that for a little bit. So when God gives a man a wife, the man is to cleave to his wife and forsake all others. Let's look at Genesis 2, 24. This goes way back to the beginning with the first marriage. Genesis 2 and verse 24. It says, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. To cleave means to stick fast or adhere, as by a glutinous surface. In wider sense, it means to cling or hold fast to attach oneself by grasping, etc. So as you see here, to cleave is a synonym of to embrace, and I will define embrace here in just a minute, and they mean similar things. And it's interesting, he says, why wilt thou embrace the bosom of a stranger? And a man's wife is called the wife of his bosom, and a wife's husband is called the husband of her bosom. So it's interesting that something about the bosom is attached and associated with marriage. So embracing the bosom of a stranger, or embracing the bosom of a person, would have a marital connotation to it. Let me give you the verses here. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 6. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 6. It says, if thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers. And he goes on to say you're supposed to kill him. But the point that I wanted from this verse was, the wife of thy bosom. And then, likewise, like I said, the husband is also referred to as the husband of the wife's bosom. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 56. It says, the tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness, her eyes shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter. These are the curses that Moses gave Israel, that if they would disobey and they wouldn't follow the Lord, that he would turn them over to all these horrible things, some of which was cannibalism, which is what he's talking about in this verse, that they would actually eat their own children because they would be that desperate. And she would turn on the husband of her own bosom. So here, both spouses are called the husband and wife of the other one's bosom. So you kind of get the idea then what Solomon is alluding to here when he says embrace the bosom of a stranger. Because technically, whenever you hug somebody, you're embracing their bosom. Right, so there's nothing wrong whenever we hug each other, when we see each other. I am not embracing your bosom. Right, there's a difference between, I am, in a sense I'm embracing it, but in the sense, in not in this sense am I doing it, right? Right, just like I could say that I know all of you, but not in a biblical sense, like Adam knew his wife, right? So there's different senses of words. So embracing the bosom of a woman is a description of sexual intimacy. If you look in Genesis 16 and verse 5, I will demonstrate this. This was probably obvious to everybody, embracing the bosom of a stranger. You probably figured that had a sexual connotation to it, but I like, if I can, to prove it from Scripture. I think that's always best. Genesis 16 and verse 5. It says, and Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. See, the husband gets the blame for everything. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. So, I mean, think about this. My wrong be upon thee. She goes on to say that what was my idea and I did it. And now it didn't turn out well and I'm mad at you. It's your fault. I mean, that's what happens sometimes. But anyway, the point that I wanted there is she said, I have given my maid into thy bosom. So that was obviously meant to say he's given her to him for sexual purposes, to bring about a son, which was the ultimate purpose. And then there's this verse in Song of Solomon, 2 and verse 6. And if it's in Song of Solomon, you can pretty well figure you know what it's talking about. Song of Solomon, 2 and verse 6. Solomon's wife says, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me. So he is embracing her bosom. This is speaking of the love act. To embrace is to clasp in the arms, usually as a sign of fondness or friendship. So you see that it was similar to cleave, as I said. To cleave was to cling or hold fast to attach oneself to. And the bosom is the breast of a human being, also poetically of a bird. It's the enclosure formed by the breast and the arms in one's bosom, means clasped to one's breast. The wife of one's bosom, that phrase, is a Hebraism adopted in the Bible of 1611, but its English use is influenced by senses 6a and b, which we don't need to look at that. The similar phrase, husband of one's bosom, never became current. Hence, to take one's bosom means to marry, or to take to one's bosom means to marry. So Solomon is getting at there that you are treating a woman like your wife if you embrace the bosom of this strange woman. Now why, when you have a wife whom God has given you for your enjoyment, would you look to another for your sexual fulfillment? That's the question. Why ruin your life? You know, why hurt your wife? Think about that. Why would you do that? It's not only a sin against her, it's also a sin against God. And it will bring men into judgment from God and men. remember we saw from Proverbs 5, 9 through 11, all of the judgments that come about by embracing the bosom of a stranger. There in 9 through 11, lest thou give thine honor unto others and thy years unto the cruel, you get dishonor, you get reproach. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, you end up paying out your money in alimony or child support, and thy labors be in the house of a stranger, and thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed. That's the STDs that we looked at. So yes, you will get judgment from God for doing this. So why would you do it? Why would you do it when you know that it's going to hurt everybody around you and it's going to destroy yourself? And I'll close out this verse with a comment from Matthew Henry in his commentary when he was commenting on this passage. He says, let him then scorn the offer of forbidden pleasures when he is always ravished with the love of a faithful, virtuous wife. Let him consider what an absurdity it will be for him to be ravished with a strange woman, Proverbs 5:20, to be in love with a filthy harlot and embrace the bosom of a stranger, which, if he had any sense of virtue or honor, he would loathe the thoughts of. Why wilt thou be so sottish, such an enemy to thyself, as to prefer puddle water, and that poison too and stolen, before pure living waters out of thine own well? Note, if the dictates of reason may be heard, the laws of virtue will be obeyed. And he's going back to what Solomon is saying here when he asks the question, he's reasoning with him. If the dictates of reason will be heard, the laws of virtue will be obeyed. So that takes care of verse 20.